And our main speaker tonight is Judy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I am Judy, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And first, I have to say that there's nowhere I would rather be and nothing I would rather be doing than speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It is thrilling to see all of you and hear all of you and know that we're on the same journey together, whether it's a day or many years. And I want to tell you that I am a member of the Lenox Hill Group in New York City. I go to meetings all over New York, but that's my home group. My sobriety date is April 20th, 1978, and my husband is here with me, whom I met 4 days before I got sober. God is mysteriously good. Now, he has never really seen me drunk, my husband. Pity. What he missed, you'll never know. That's probably why he's still here. And my oldest friend in sobriety, Virginia, with whom I got sober and struggled through the days when we were here, when we walked in the door, we said, oh my God, all the years we came to the meeting here, we were never allowed inside the church. We were always downstairs at Central. And Central was an amazing meeting, and this is an amazing meeting. And it was a big meeting like this, quite big, and many, many people of different lengths of sobriety, which is what we need. We need to see people who are just coming in, who are just here a day or two, and people who've been around the block and been in here many years and have kept coming to meetings. That's the secret. I mean, if there is a secret, it's read the big book and go to meetings. Read the big book. I read the big book as many times as I can a week. It travels, and I have one in my purse here, the little one, which I'm very grateful for. They've graduated the different sizes since I got sober, and now they're big ones. They're in Braille. They're in Spanish, and then they're in different sizes. They're also in large print, which I'm getting more and more happy about. You know, it's... I will tell you that I was raised in an alcoholic family. The alcoholism in my family was deep and generations old and destructive and also very illuminating, because alcoholics are smart people. A lot of them are brilliant people. A lot of them have incredibly deep work ethics. A lot of alcoholics do things that other individuals might find impossible. They accomplish and overcome things that are hard to do. And in my family, my alcoholic father, whom I pray for every day and think about every day because of the battle that he fought with the demon alcohol, he was also blind. And I was very confused growing up. Was it the blindness that made him so Jekyll and Hyde and so crazy? Was it the alcohol? I didn't know that. But by the time I was 18, 19, I knew that whatever it was that he had, I had. And I had it so that I was powerless and could have come here at 19. I could not turn away a drink. I could not stop drinking once I started. I threw up. I carried on. I danced on the tables. You know, I was sexually inappropriate from the beginning. And I mean, this was throughout my behavior. All of my behaviors were insane when I was drinking. And because I was always drinking, on some level or other, my thinking and my behavior were always not sane. They were not. I probably haven't been like the person that I was when I was 4. That's who I think of in sobriety. I think about that girl. You know, I have pictures of her naked in a bathtub, smiling in the sunlight, happy and joyous and free, even in that alcoholic family. And I see her and I think that's actually who I'm becoming. That's the returning to sanity that I got, although certainly I didn't think I was crazy. Everything I did in my life was determined by what I could get to drink, how much of it, what kind, when I was married, when I was divorced, when I lost custody of my son, when I got custody back of my son. All of these times were underscored by what I was drinking, how I was training myself to make the bed stay still while the whole room swirled, and training myself that I would, next time, I would drink the martini the right way so that that wouldn't happen. The first time I came home from an event with a couple of girlfriends driving in Colorado to go somewhere to hear a big chorus sing. On the way back, it was me who had the bottle of gin in the back seat of the car when I was 16, and me who was throwing up all over the floor, and my mother who said to me, "Well, what were you drinking?" And I told her it was gin, and she said, "Don't drink gin. It's very simple." And so I didn't anymore. I drank everything else. I drank with a wish and a will to be out of the world, to be gone, to be... Quite often, I think nowadays, alcohol today looks to me like the inconvenient substance that stands between me and being completely gone, between oblivion, because I drank for oblivion. I drank into blackout. I drank determinately into blackout. I see young people now, they have, you know, 1 year plans, 2 year plans. I had a 24-hour plan, and my plan was to get drunk. And I had been trained as a child. I was trained in the field that I pursued as a profession, and I was seriously committed. I was seriously required to spend time and effort and energy doing something every day on a daily basis. So that discipline from my childhood was a deep part of my denial. It held me off from reality for way, way, way too long. I drank for 23 years, and in the beginning, of course, success came to me extremely easily. I say easily. I worked like a horse, as I always have and always probably will. But it was easy. It unfolded while I thought about how I could get that pint and then that half quart and then that half, you know, and then that quart into my body. While I thought about how do I get drunk enough today, things just unfolded. My higher power was alcohol, of course, but also I had a huge amount of faith. I like very much being in churches. I've always loved being in churches. I think that the idea that we're taken care of, that we are drunks and addicts and alcoholics who are taken care of by God, is very true. And I was taken care of. I was held through the drama and through the insanity. And the insanity was, was constant. I worked with as all of us do, and many of us have this experience, with the burden, with the requirements of being an active alcoholic. You know, this is a real page of things that have to be done in order to be an alcoholic and stay looking like you aren't, as best you can. And it is a long list. And in a way, when we turn the corner, when I turned the corner and was given sobriety, which is the gift, the list was a different list, but it was just as long. And it meant transforming all of those things that I did into other habits, other mental habits, other physical habits, not going places that I don't belong. Opening a bottle today of something called Synergy. Did you ever hear of Synergy? I saw a friend today in a store, and I was buying my groceries, and she was buying Synergy. And she said, "Oh, yeah, we keep 20, 30 bottles in the fridge." And we and I said, "Great." I said, I looked at it, 35 calories. Whoa, that's for me. I bought some. I opened one. It sort of burst out of the jar. And then I read, it said, you know, this may contain alcohol because it's fermented. I said, "Oh, my God." You know, everywhere you turn, you have to be as vigilant. So, you know, I can't have that. That's another thing that I can't have, because it smells like booze. It acts like beer. Can I drink a near beer? No. No way. I can't touch it. I can't go near it. You know, it says we reacted. You know, we responded as if we were touching poison, because it is poison to our systems. In the big book, in the doctor's opinion, it tells me what was the matter with me. I did not know what was the matter with me. I knew that I was an alcoholic, and I talked about this with therapists. I moved to New York in 1963, and I immediately went into therapy. I had had a suicide attempt at 14. I think living in the alcoholic family, in the untreated Al-Anon family, and in the alcoholic family, but I had not started to drink at that point. But by the time I didn't have a handle on anything. I didn't know how anything was done. My discipline, my skill, my art saved me. I had friends who were just as nuts as I was, and we loved to be together. And as I got older, I loved to be with people who drank like I did. When I got into therapy in New York, I got into therapy with a group of people called the Sullivanians, of whom you may have heard, some of you, and they liked to treat their patients with alcohol. They said, you know, if you have a problem, if you're nervous, have a drink. I stayed there for 15 years. I was in all kinds of therapy. I was in an encounter group here, which was started by the guys who started the Phoenix House encounter groups. And they were wonderful guys, and I was crazy about them. And they were running these groups of us Upper West Siders. And one day, the leader of the group said to me, you know, this was about, I had 8 years, 10 years, I suppose, to go before I got sober. He said, you know, you're a drunk. You know, you've always got a drink in your hand. You've always got a cigarette in your hand. And I stopped. I said, no, I'm neither one. Of course, I stopped for 2 months on a dare. In the 23 years that I drank, I remember distinctly 5 months and 10 days that I did not drink. I did not try to control my drinking those 10 days and those 5 months I did. But one was for a physical thing, and one was on this dare, this guy who had the nerve to tell me I was a drunk. And there was no other way to live. As I say, I talked about being an alcoholic. I talked about it. I took pride in it. I knew that if I was an alcoholic, there was nothing that you could do about it or I could do about it. And so I drank in this way at everything, at everyone, but mostly because that's what I was. I was an alcoholic. I would take anything you gave me. Took a lot of pills, ups, downs, sideways, to lose weight, to sleep, to do things, to work. I loved speed. And I loved anything that took me away, but the devotion, the commitment was to alcohol, because that's what made me alive and capable of having a life in this world. I was afraid, the one thing I was afraid of was not having enough alcohol. And my great desire in all this successful life, and I had a very successful and still have, but it was almost gone at the end. I had a great desire, you know, as I said, other people have these 5-year plans. They think about where they want to be, what they want to do, how they want. I had a dream, which was to make enough money to buy a lodge in Colorado and stock it with booze and drink myself to death. Well, I had an apartment in New York, and I'd stocked it with booze and was drinking myself to death. I didn't have to move anywhere. I was here. Thank God I didn't have to drive in New York, because I had a number of incidents which I've remembered over the years as things get clearer and clearer. I found, you know, in those days, I say like in those days, but it was true. You didn't turn Oprah on and find out that so-and-so had just come out of Betty Ford. It was not that kind of a time. I mean, the closest that I came to interventions was that on the taxis, there was a little sign that said, trouble with your drinking? Call this number. And I would go like this, you know. But once in a while, I would see someone talking about alcohol. It was shocking. It was like they'd, you know, they'd said used the bad language and been politically incorrect, and shame on them for talking about this thing that I had. And in the early part of 1978, I had had surgery on my voice. I'm a singer. surgery on my voice. Couldn't sing anymore. It canceled most of the previous year's work because I couldn't sing. I could sing for a while, and then I would lose it, and I'd have to go on drugs to get the voice back. And that was cracking and shattering and going. And I had a surgery for that, which was successful. It's a surgery that's been unsuccessful with other people, but it was successful with me. By that time, I had a son who was very, very active and deeply in his own addiction. And this beloved son of mine was using and drinking at the time I got sober. I called a friend who was married to a very, very active and very visible drunk in the city. I would see him on the cover of the Post or something, beating somebody up in front of a bar and falling down in a state of, you know, being carted away by the police and so on. And I didn't know him personally, but I knew his wife just a little bit. And I didn't see him in the papers anymore. He sort of had disappeared. And so I said to her, I called her up and I said, what's with your husband? And she said, well, he's sober. And I said, really? How could he get sober? How could someone like that get sober? I knew that I'd talked to all my therapists about AA. Well, it was for old men in raincoats, and it certainly wasn't for me. That was it. That was the picture of Alcoholics Anonymous. Doctors, it's understandable because they get about 4 hours of addiction in medical school. So that's one of the reasons that all my fancy high-class doctors had always said, well, have you considered having a highball? You know, nobody had a clue when I would talk about my drinking. Nobody had a clue. And so I called this guy. She said, well, why don't you call him up? He was in California working on a film. He was an actor. And he spent about 40 minutes on the phone with me. And at that point, my writing was that great, big, illegible kind of writing that you couldn't read the next day. But he told me about a doctor in New York, and he told me the meetings he went to. So I wrote down all the meetings, and I started going to the meetings in New York, drinking, and unable to tolerate being at Lenox Hill with that spotlight and that stage. And here, it would not have been possible for me to sit in this room, I don't think, when I was still drinking. I couldn't manage to sit through a meeting, and I would have to get to a drink. So I called him up again, and I said, where should I go? And he said, go to see this guy, Dr. Gitlow. Stanley Gitlow is a great man, and he's been a friend to alcoholics for many, many decades in New York and helped many, many, many people. He gets us. He understands us. And when he looks at us, he doesn't see a crazy person. He sees someone who's sick and needs help, and he recognizes the symptoms. So I went to see him, and at that point, you know, I was wearing a lot of hats and a lot of scarves and a lot of dark glasses and a lot of, you know, hovering down the street. I didn't want to be seen. I didn't want to be talked to. I had, for a long time, anybody who had questioned my drinking was no longer in my life. And I couldn't work anymore. It was gone. I had had that surgery and drunk all the way through the surgery. I was so drunk the morning they did the surgery, I'm surprised I didn't die on the table. It was not possible for me in the 4 years before I came into AA. I was not able to not drink. I mean, it was round the clock. It was every day. I had had my denial, and I would not sing when I was working, and that was gone by the last year. I was working in blackouts when I could work. So there was nothing left. I did not know how I could go on living, and I was not living. You know, it was dark. It was very, very dark. And I went into this man's office, and I guess I had an intervention in a way, because he said, well, you could check yourself into a mental institution. You could just drink yourself to death, and you'll accomplish that pretty quickly now. Or you could go into treatment. 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 What was that? Treatment. And he said, I know a place. I'm not on the board of directors. I just think they're great. And so one morning in April 19th, I got on an airplane. Oh, by the way, I have to tell you something about this place. It was Chit Chat. It's now Karen. It's known as Karen now, but it was Chit Chat. It was a drunk farm. And I called them up and I told them my situation, and they said I had to be sober for 72 hours before I came. And I said, I can't do that. What do you mean 72 hours? I didn't understand. I can't get through this next few minutes here. I mean, talking to you is interfering with my basic thing that I do. You don't get it. So I hung up on them, thinking, well, that's another plan that's not going to go anywhere. And they called me back a few minutes later, and they said they had discovered they had a detox there. So I got on this plane at 4 in the morning, and I was already drunk by the time it was 7, and I had arrived in Wernersville, and I had this jelly jar full of alcohol, of course I was drinking, you know, the great famous, you can't tell, vodka. How would anybody know? You know, nowadays, once in a while, on a plane or at a party, I'll sit down with someone whose body is, the fumes are coming off. You ever know what I mean? And the smell, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbearable because you hear all the things that you've heard about this disease and how it goes through the body and where it goes and where it doesn't go. And that's how I must have smelled for years, actually. And so I happily went into the bathroom at this airport and downed all the rest of this vodka. And I was really in a good mood. The guy picked me up in the little station wagon, and I had a bag of books. I had a typewriter. I was going to write the novel and so on and so forth. I tell you, Chit Chat, everything about it saved my life. It was spring, first of all. I hadn't seen anything. I hadn't had an intuition. You know, it talks in the promises about we will intuitively know. I had not had a spark of an idea, an intuition, for years. I mean, it was really like gray fuzz covering my head and my face and my. And as I said, I met my husband 4 days before. I had put off going to treatment so that I could go and do this. I didn't know I'd meet him, but I could go and do this benefit that this man who had literally 12-stepped me was running. So when I got there and I put the books down and the nurse said, why don't you just let us drive? And you know, that's what it is. I am so grateful that I am willing, that I was willing to let you guys drive because you know what to do. So we had the big book from the beginning. We had the steps. I did my first fourth step there with a guy who had told his story in a step meeting, and I'd said, if he can get sober, I can get sober. With that horrible story, as horrible as mine, I knew if he could do it, I could do it. And that's how we go along. You know, my son had 7 years of sobriety when he relapsed and in 1992 took his life. And so I know what happens when you don't follow the path and grab the gift of sobriety. I've seen a lot of people die of this disease. I've seen a lot of people that were here with me and with my friend when we first came in who aren't here anymore. And the people who stay here are doing the steps. They're reading the book. They're involved in the story of Bill and Bob. They want to know the history. They want to go get Charlie and Joe tapes. They want to read about and see and digest and take in the old timers and their experiences. They want to be a part of this in every ounce of their life. They want to be connected on a daily basis with something about sobriety that's so deep that they don't let it go. They don't have to think up reasons to do the steps. They're threaded within our lives. I do have to do the work. I do have to go to the meetings. I go to more meetings as I get sober longer. I always went to a lot of meetings, so maybe that's not fair. I go to as many meetings as I can. I go to regular meetings. I try to go to step meetings. I try to think about what was it that happened in Akron? What was that miracle? how did that get into this book? How did this thing happen? Well, you know, they knew. Somehow they knew. And, you know, he worked so hard, Bill. You know, I'm reading a little bit about, you know, how difficult it was to be vigilant, to run this whole setup so that people would get the idea of how it works without leaders, without laws, without musts, except if you go through the big book, of course, it says 115 times must and have to. And I recommend that I go through that book and underline that in the fourth edition as I've done in the third edition. Because there wasn't, you know, there wasn't any question when I came in of a suggestion. I was done. I was cooked, for which I'm eternally grateful. I had had it. I had done everything that I could think of not to drink. Not that I would control my drinking, but just that I would get my life in shape, you know. Just that I would do it differently, that I would exercise more, that I would eat differently, that I would go to various and sundry. I remember going to Est. Now, you know, I don't know if you remember Est, but it was very exciting for the time. And the thing that they wanted, though, that week between the first and second weekends, you were not supposed to drink. I never went back. Are you kidding? To tell an alcoholic that they're not allowed to drink for the week between the two weekends, how is that possible? You can't tell an alcoholic not to drink. I was going to drink, and I was going to miss that wonderful, exciting thing where you either, I don't know exactly what happened to you when you finished that weekend, since I never did it. But one thing I knew was that I got stoned, and I got ripped, and I got drunk, and I passed out, and I was in a blackout. And to me, that was where I wanted to be. I always wanted to be there. So how is it that I'm here? How could I have this life, which is an extraordinary life? I have not taken a drink. I have not taken a pill. I have not had it found it necessary to take any mood-altering chemical in these years. Not only in these years, but even after my son died, because I have the place to go that tells me how to live. And I knew when he died that I was at risk, like we all are, and that the only hope that I had was to do it the way you said to do it, and the way Bill and Dr. Bob did it. And I celebrate my life today. I celebrate it with my friends, with my family, with my work. I mean, my work has taken me in places that are impossible for a woman who came in here with really nothing and who couldn't get up in the morning and not drink and take pills and do whatever it was. It's an impossibility that I'm here sober today, but it happened. So I believe in miracles, and Christmas is coming, and that's the best time not to drink. Any day is the best time not to drink, but to be awake for what's going on today in the street. You know, when I saw the flowers outside the windows, and I went to the little meditation meeting at 6:30 on this farm, chit-chat, I would go, I never saw that color before. I haven't seen that color before. And things began to go off. Little lights, little flickers, little moments started to happen. I was sitting in the basement of the church on 70th or 71st, and I forget what it was called then. And it was a basement, of course, where we usually meet. And there was this line across the top of the wall. There was a little line of very simple stained glass windows. They weren't fancy. They weren't brilliant. They weren't filled with stories from the Bible. It was just a line of pieces of nice-looking kind of yellow glass. And that was one of my epiphanies, you know. I looked at that row of yellow glass and the light coming through it. And it was like I was lifted out of my body and put on some cloud. That's what happens to me in an AA meeting. When Luke was talking, when he started to get to the end of his story, I got that thing, which I get when I hear a story. You know, it lifts me up. It heals me. You heal me. And for my sobriety and for my life, I want to thank all of you and AA, and thank you so much.